Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and this is Film Weekly. On the show this week, I meet director Catherine Bigelow, one of the finest artists working on the big screen today. She's back with a bang, a very big bang. The Hurt Locker is a suffocatingly intense story of the Iraq War from the perspective of an American Army bomb squad. That's coming up. And speaking of dynamite, an elite squad of critics, well, myself and Zan Brooks, will be disarming and disassembling Pedro Almodovar's Broken Embraces with Penelope Cruz and Funny People, the latest comic offering from Judd Apatow and Adam Sandler. Plus, novelist, poet and documentary maker Xiaolu Guo last week took the prestigious Golden Leopard at Locarno. I'll be meeting her to find out more about her winning feature, She, a Chinese. Enough with the bomb-related puns already, and on with an explosive female-dominated Film Weekly.
You're a wild man, you know that?
Yes,
sir. He's a wild man, you know that? Why don't you shake your hand?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure, sir.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked your question.
873.
That's just hot shit. 873.
They're counting today, sir, yes.
That's gotta be a record. What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That's a good one. I've spoken like a wild man.
Jeremy Renner there as the unhinged Sergeant James, and David Morse making a guest appearance as Colonel Reed in Catherine Bigelow's new feature, The Hurt Locker. The film is an intense and intimate portrait of an elite bomb squad on the streets of Iraq and marks a breathless return to form for Bigelow, best known for her films Point Break, starring Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze, and Strange Days with Ralph Fiennes and Angela Bassett, the sci-fi thriller about New Year's Eve in Los Angeles 2000. I went to interview Catherine Bigelow as part of my In the Director's Chair series for Guardian.co.uk, and I started out by asking her what had drawn her to these characters and the terrifying detail of this war.
Well, I think the idea was to make the movie as realistic and authentic as possible, and we had the great benefit of Mark Bowles' first-hand observation from his embed in Baghdad in 2004, and I think just the day in the life of a bomb tech in Baghdad at that time certainly is inherently dramatic. I mean, these are men who arguably have the most dangerous job in the world. They're walking toward what you and I and perhaps the rest of the world would run from.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be that you as a director often do that, the subject placed in front of you are not the easiest subjects, and the way that you tackle them is not the easiest way. In fact, a challenge is something you relish, isn't it?
I think probably subconsciously I'll tend to be drawn to something that's more difficult than less.
Yeah. And even more dangerous, something explosive, in fact.
Right.
So is that what interests you about these guys? Because there are millions of stories of extreme danger. In fact, you've chronicled some of them before. Let's say in Point Break, for example, where it was crime and violence and extreme sports that were attractive. They seem heroes within themselves for that reason, too, these guys who do the exploding.
Well, I think what really attracted me was the psychology. You know, these are men who, in America certainly, it's a volunteer military, so these are men who are there by choice. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's an unimaginable courage that they must possess in order to do what they do on a daily basis, 10, 12, 15 times a day. And at the same time, they're saving lives, you know, hundreds, perhaps thousands of lives.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty admirable and pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that and take the psychology of that they are saving lives. Because in a way, your film sort of avoids the wider issue of what they're doing. I mean, it seems that so intense and so concentrated are they on the task in hand that the wider issues of politics and saving lives and heroism don't even come into it. In fact, your film starts with the opening words, "War is a drug." It seems these guys are kind of more intent on doing what they do rather than thinking about the wider issues.
Well, I think the context is there as well, but, you know, I think the specificity of it is what's so you know, so kind of rich and certainly unusual. Again, you know, I think it's a conflict that's really abstract to most people. Mm. And to kind of unpack it and give it detail and give it specificity is in and of itself, you know, a real eye-opener. You know, I think of it as being specific to this conflict just because, you know, the weapon of the insurgency are bombs, and the EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, finds himself at the epicenter of this particular conflict. But nonetheless, you know, I think it's, you know, I think if one can make a piece of entertainment and yet inject substance into it, I think that's kind of, I don't know, for me, that sort of holy grail filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is a detachment to it, which I liked. In fact, a sort of, it's a series of standoffs, isn't it? I suppose that's what the lives of these fellows is like. But it unfolds, and it, you know, you have the countdown of days, and we have the, here they are again, another situation. But there's sort of variants on a theme. They kind of you kind of improvise around the central theme of danger. Is that because, as you say, that's the real issue of their lives?
I think it's the real issue and the real sort of nature of a day in the life of a bomb tech today, you know, or certainly in 2004, that it's just, it, you know, feels kind of like this inexorable tide of, I don't know, of potential violence.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a rush as well. I mean, it must be, I mean, you, I suppose as the director, you've got close to this idea, you've intuited a kind of, say, that was a real bomb. I mean, the rush must be extraordinary. It must equal the rush of jumping out of a plane or surfing the biggest wave ever that we saw in Point Break.
Well, I certainly think it takes a phenomenal amount of courage. And where that comes from, you know, if it's, you know, however that is manifested, that, you know, it's, again, it's almost unimaginable what it would take to bend over, to become, you know, up close and personal to something that could be so catastrophic. You know, there's no margin for error. Mm. You know, if you're a surgeon, like being a surgeon, you have to have that kind of incredible motor skills. But yet, if you're a surgeon and you've made a mistake, the patient dies. In this case, if you've made a mistake, you die.
Yeah.
You know, it's extraordinary.
I quite enjoyed, and I'm sure you did too, actually, the clunk and the click of the materials, the belts, the kind of robots, all the equipment, really. And it kind of felt like the bomb disposal team, kind of a bit like a film crew when they arrived. There's a lot of stuff to play with. It seems to me that you're an equipment junkie, though. All your films are pretty good on the porn of equipment.
On the porn of equipment. I love that term. I may have to quote it. I don't know. I mean, certainly those are the tools that you need, certainly, to make something that has that is both experiential, kinetic, yeah, and impactful. You know, you need a certain amount of equipment, of GAC, yeah, around you. And you also need a great crew, and I had a phenomenal crew in this movie with Barry Aykroyd,
yeah,
who's a cinematographer.
I wanted to talk about your use of Barry Aykroyd, because he's a sort of hero of British cinema, of course.
Well, he's my hero, too.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's the perfect person to be in the trenches with. I mean, here we are in 115-degree heat every single day in the middle of summer in, you know, the Middle East, probably 5 kilometers outside of the country of Iraq. And it's really punishing, and he was indefatigable.
Really? Because, I mean, he's used to shooting with Ken Loach in northern England. It's a bit chillier. You know what I mean? I was thinking, oh, I don't know, Barry, if you're going to survive that heat.
He was perfect.
Where did you discover his work, and why did you decide to use him? Because, interestingly, he's a hero to a whole generation of British filmmakers, including Nick Broomfield, who'd shot in Jordan previously,
yes,
with his,
yes,
Iraq documentary.
Yes.
And I think with Paul Greengrass, he shot United 93 for Paul Greengrass, who was there, and then he shot the Green Zone, I think, for
uh-huh,
Paul, and your film also mentions the Green Zone, so there's a whole kind of activity. I don't know if there's a war going on in Iraq, but there's a right filmmaking community going on just over the border in Jordan.
Well, I certainly was familiar with United 93, thought it was incredible, and then saw Wind That Shakes the Barley, and, you know, like, this is a man who has phenomenal range, so there's nothing that he can't, mm-hmm, you know, handle. And, you know, let's add to that the Middle East and see what happens.
Yeah.
And we're really lucky.
Yeah, because, I mean, the work is extraordinary, the kind of kineticism of his work, which I presume is combined with your kind of keeping it going, I suppose. Is that what you're like on set as a director? I know you don't use the
You'd
chair.
You'd have to ask him.
Yes, I suppose you're not probably the best qualified to say what you're like on set.
I know.
I'm lovely.
I certainly think there were no really calm moments and no rest periods. I mean, you know, everybody was pretty much in motion. I mean, we shot for 44 days and came back with 1 million feet of film. So it was intense.
Mm, thank you for coming in the director's
Appreciate
chair.
Appreciate it. Thank
nice
you
to meet
so
you,
much.
Catherine. Thank you.
The Hurt Locker, and it really is one of the finest films this year, goes on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 28th of August. And you can see another version of this interview by going to guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. Different versions, the same interview, and it's still a brilliant film, whichever way you look at it. And now we move to another tense standoff. It's that part of the show where Zan Brooks faces me off in the Film Weekly studio to discuss this week's other releases, including Judd Apatow's latest Funny People, starring Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen, Pedro Almodovar's Broken Embraces with a glorious Penelope Cruz, and we'll be talking about Vincent Cassel in Meereen. We'll also be discussing the 25 greatest British films of the last 25 years, to be published this weekend in the Observer's Film Quarterly magazine. But first, let's hear from Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen in Judd Apatow's Funny People. George, a grumpy comic played by Adam Sandler, confides in Ira, played by Seth Rogen, that he's got a life-threatening blood disease and that he's going to take him on to be his new assistant. But before that, he's got a couple of tasks he wants him to perform.
Why are you telling me this, George?
Because I want you to possibly do me a favor.
Okay, yeah, what?
Kill me.
What?
Nobody knows we know each other. You're a stranger. You can get away with this. I got a gun in the other room. It's untraceable. I'll give you $50,000. Don't make me suffer. Please. Kill me, Ira. I'm begging you.
Can you at least give me like a night to think about it?
Ha! Think about it! You would do it!
Oh, I hate you, man. Oh, no!
Ira, I misread you. You're sick. What would you have done for $100,000? Chop my head off? You would still want to do it. That wasn't even good acting over there.
That was good acting.
Daniel Day-Lewis would have crushed that speech.
I bought that, man.
Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen in Funny People. They're written and directed by Judd Apatow. I was a bit surprised when I saw this coming up, Zan, that Judd Apatow had a sort of very long 150-minute film that seemed to be on the outside of it, a quite serious piece.
It's quite a serious piece, and it's a film that I think looks back, doesn't it? I mean, Adam Sandler and Judd Apatow were roommates back in the day when they were both learning their craft on the LA comedy circuit. And this is a film about that. This is a film that basically looks back at those early years and then follows it through. So it shows us that world and all the rungs of that world. So Seth Rogen is basically at the bottom and Adam Sandler is at the top. But neither of them are particularly happy, neither of them particularly content. And then in the meantime, you've got these other rungs occupied by people like Jason Schwartzman, who's Seth Rogen's roommate, who's making like 25 grand a week, doing well, but he's in some sort of piece of crap TV sitcom called Yo Teach.
Yo Teach.
Which is, I guess, is like head of the class.
Doesn't he? And there's one bit where he sort of says, you know who wrote that? William Shakespeare.
And he says to the kids, word.
Yes, he does.
So basically, this is... It's a kind of poisoned Valentine to that whole world. And at times I wasn't sure whether Apatow loves this world or hates it. But either way, he's kind of in it.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, he's done The 40-Year-Old Virgin, he's done Knocked Up. And those are kind of knockabout comedies. There's lots of fart jokes and kind of sexy jokes in them. This was a sort of change of pace for it, because that is a bit... It is bitterer, and it is kind of slightly more reflective.
It is bitterer, but then you also have to remember that Apatow also learned his craft as a writer on the Larry Sanders Show, which was one of the great shows of the 1990s, and had that same sourness that you get here. And maybe that is more the sort of films that he ideally wants to make, and this is his attempt to do it. At times I thought this was really kind of going for the Holy Grail, which is a properly bleak film about comedy and comedians. But then I think it chickened out, and I think it lost its way.
It becomes a different film, doesn't it? It becomes sort of more sentimental when there's a sort of family element to it. In fact, his wife, Leslie Mann, who I think is a perfectly sort of amusing comic actress, she sort of gets a bigger part in it, and it becomes a sort of sentimental family drama. It's a kind of strange mix, though, but I did think in parts it worked really, really well. I was reminded of Broadway Danny Rose in parts where all the comedians sit around sort of reminiscing over their kind of old times and how things have changed them.
And there's an affectionate nature to these comedians, but there's also a real spite, and they're also ambitious. And there's a warmth and a camaraderie, but at the same time, you know that they would easily step on each other's throats to get ahead.
Absolutely.
And it does catch that world. But you're right. I felt that the first half of this film worked a lot better for me than the second half. The first part, I was completely involved and completely believing in it. And then it just becomes this sort of meandering buddy comedy, which is almost too intelligent to go for the Hollywood cliches. But at the same time, because it doesn't really have anything to replace it, it's sort of skirting around the Hollywood cliches and sort of wandering all over the place.
I was wondering that if this was in French, for example, and was directed by Arnaud Desplechin, that we would think, wow, well, this is amazing because it doesn't follow any structure and it's rambling and it's all over the place and it's part sentimental, part bitter, and it's genius. You know, there was a part of this where I thought, well, perhaps this is really, really good. I mean, there were moments when I thought, this is one of the best films I've seen this year because of its honesty, and I thought the stand-up actual routines were actually very funny that we see. Whereas in sort of British films, I saw one at the Edinburgh Festival recently about a stand-up comic who was rubbish.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to be good, but the stand-up stuff was not. These are good comedians.
Yeah, these are good comedians, and the stand-up routines work. And also, it has that sort of that slight sort of inside track quality to it, that he's using old footage of Adam Sandler's stand-up kind of woven in there to show the character, who is basically Adam Sandler but just maybe with leukemia, with a life-threatening illness.
But it's that, isn't it, that you start off as an early comedian, you've got good material, it's kind of strong, and then you get sucked into Hollywood.
And then you sell out and make kind of movies like the ones we see here, Merman, where he's a sort of male mermaid, and sort of body swap comedies where they digitally put his head on a baby.
Called
and
Redo.
All of that is great, and that all of that works, but at the same time, there was a sort of dying fall, I think, to this film. And there was also there's something unbecoming, finally, about millionaires telling us that, hey, it's not so great on the top. It's lonely up there. And you think, well, get off the top then. And that was the problem that I had with this film. Spare me.
That's funny, people, though, which I would actually recommend people go to see. It is very long. It's like 150 minutes.
Mm, and sort too of long.
Doesn't need to be that long. Let's move on to Pedro Almodovar, another fairly long film, Broken Embraces, which was at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year. Let's have a little clip of Penelope Cruz in action. She's playing Lena. She arrives on set in a wheelchair. For those who speak Spanish, it probably makes much more sense.
Dime la verdad. La gente no se cae por la escalera. Eso solo ocurre en las películas.
Baja la voz, Mateo. Tenemos que terminar el rodaje cuanto antes. Hasta entonces no podré dejar a Ernesto.
¿Por qué no?
Oh, me gusta mucho when Senora Cruz speaks Spanish. She's much better in Spanish than she is in English, I think. I mean, I know she won an Oscar for Vicky Cristina Barcelona, but to me that was shouting. I love her back in Almodovar. I think she's at her best working for Pedro Almodovar. Is she at her best in Broken Embraces, Sam Brooks?
I think she is. She's certainly at her most ravishing. This really is a film about the artist and his muse. And it's almost as if Pedro Almodovar is like a child who's just been presented with the greatest doll in the world and is wanting to show her off. So he's like putting wigs on her, he's putting dresses on her, he's making her pout, he's making her cry, he's making her look sexy. And it's a huge valentine to Penelope Cruz, this film. It's totally self-indulgent, but it's utterly seductive as
well. And it's about a director and a difficulty of making
movies. Exactly, because
it is a film, as they say in Cannes, it is a film about films, a movie about movies.
It's a film within a film within a film at times.
There's nothing more indulgent than a film about films, I have to say. I'm sure there are bigger subjects in the world to make films about, but we do love it when they make films about films.
Particularly when they're done this well.
Yeah.
And this is utterly seductive. It's a ravishing film. It's Luis Horner is playing a blind screenwriter called Harry Kane, who was once a filmmaker called Matteo Blanco, and the film flashes back sort of 10 years or so to find out how he got to where he is now, where Penelope Cruz is the sort of the gangster's mole, the mistress of the shady financier who funds his movies, and they fall in love. Then you throw in the financier's son, who's spying on them in the guise of making a sort of making of documentary. So there's all these sort of layers of meaning that are perfectly mounted and furnished and decorated. I'm not sure there's any actual meaning underneath all of these layers of meaning. And that is a problem that I did have with the film. And I actually
came out
of the film.
But isn't that a problem with films about films? Is that ultimately they're just about cinema and the layers of meaning?
And illusion and voyeurism and what we watch.
They're not really about, you know, life itself.
No, it's the cinema du look, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's the act of looking.
But they're fabulous. Hitchcock homages in here. Mm. There are noir homages. And he's been doing this for a while, and whatever. Did it, I think, very well in Bad Education. Mm. And he's sort of been going that way with Cruise in Volver. That was a bit more realist and comedy. But he's got the comedies in here of his old, because she's in the film making a film that looks like a bad version of one of the films that Almodovar used to make back in the 80s.
Yeah.
The Woman on the Verge kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's people acting as actors.
Yeah.
And all of that is very self-referential, and perhaps a little bit up itself. In fact, so far up itself that you can't even see its feet. It's gone right up
but
there.
If you go with it up there...
If you go up there with it, it's wonderful. And I did. I kind of resisted it. And at times I thought, is this a film that is actually really irritating me? Because I don't actually think it adds up too much. It's like a beautiful piece of sort of spun candy floss that looks absolutely ravishing, tastes amazing, and just sort of fades away, melts away to nothing. But in the end, I thought, that's okay.
That's Broken Embraces on release this week. And Zan, we're going to go to France now as well. From Spain, we'll go to France to look at Mesrine, or Mesrine, as most people are calling it. In fact, that's exactly what happens to the gangster Jacques Mesrine. He gets annoyed when people don't call him Mesrine, but most people do call him Mesrine. We had the first part out, which was in English titled Mesrine, Killer Instinct. Now the second part is out, Mesrine, Public Enemy Number One. It's all very confusing. It's a two-part thriller in that case, but you've only seen one part, and I think a lot of people don't even know. I've been talking to people that said, I've seen that great film with Vincent Cassel and Gérard Depardieu and Cécile de France. Brilliant, wasn't it? And I said, yeah, well, you've got to go see the second part. They don't even know there's a second part coming out.
Yeah.
So can you see
and
them
I'm even
separately?
In a worse position, because I got it completely back-arsewards, didn't I? That I've seen the second part but not the first
because
part.
Because it's called Public Enemy Number One, so you think it's the first part.
They're really playing with our heads, these filmmakers this week. But it didn't bother me. It didn't bother me. I liked Public Enemy Number One Part Two.
Yes.
It completely connected. It's a great, ripping, confident, old-style gangster film.
And with a fantastic performance by Vincent Cassel in the middle of it. I mean, he's put on weight. Certainly in the second part, I mean, he's got this belly, he's got this moustache. Mesrine was the man with a thousand faces. So he puts on loads of kind of disguises, kind of big wigs and kind of big glasses. There's a bald bit as well.
It did make me think, though, that, you know, this film is a real 70s, it really wallows in its 70s ambience.
There's a bit of funkiness.
And I thought that maybe that's the best time to be a master of disguise in the 70s, because they were all having sort of wearing big hair and big mutton chop sideburns and their collars turned up and things like that. And that was the era of the master of disguise.
You could easily be a master.
Everyone was a master of disguise in the 1970s. And it does catch that. And it also has, you know, Ludwig Sanier as the gangster's mole sort of tottering around in high heels and a slit skirt, which
I
always
like.
Helps.
I like that too. I like both parts. They are. I've done some research for you. Both parts are currently now out in your cinema, so you can go and see both parts. They're not showing together, though, so you might have to do that amazing thing where you see one part in one cinema and part two in another cinema.
That's almost like a kind of thriller itself. You see one, and then when the credits roll, you run across town to the next
or
cinema.
You have to track it down using a variety of
modern
devices.
And maybe you can kind of switch clothes on the way.
Yeah, grow a moustache if you've got time. That's Mesrine, starring Vincent Cassel. You can, of course, listen to my Film Weekly interview with the great Vincent Cassel about talking about Mesrine and the rest of his great career from La Haine onwards. That's still on the Film Weekly series list here at The Guardian. But I mentioned there, Zan, that Mesrine is a very French film. We don't make those films in Britain, but we do make films here in Britain. And this weekend in the Observer Film Quarterly magazine, there is a contentious list, Zan, of the greatest 25 British films of the last 25 years. I was part of it, contributing my top 10, and I won't give away the list entirely. You have to go out and buy The Observer on Sunday to see the final list. But films like Secrets and Lies, Sexy Beast, Man on Wire, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Ratcatcher, Trainspotting, Slumdog Millionaire, they're all in there. Which order they're in, I'm not going to tell you. But what do you think of the list so far? What do you think of British filmmaking over the last 25 years? You've got 2 minutes.
Well, when you see it like this, 25 years, 25 films, it looks pretty good. But, you know, bear in mind this is a quarter of a century we're talking about. So if there aren't 25 good films there, then we're really, really in trouble, aren't we?
Interestingly, I was given the task of a top 10, and I thought, well, great. Well, I'm going to have to remember what happened 25 years ago. That's going back to 1984. Well, you go back to 84, and there's about four films made a year. Up until about 1992, when there's an activity. There was nothing made. There was John Borman's Hope and Glory. There's a bit of Derek Jarman, maybe a bit of Peter Greenaway. But we weren't making any films here in the 80s and early 90s. And it took really Trainspotting to really galvanise things. I suppose Shallow Grave really galvanised, but then the lottery money of the night of the yeah. 90s really kind of.
But that was a case of quantity, production. Not quality, wasn't it? A lot of them.
Well, I've written a piece for the magazine also. But wait, I mean, yes, there is quality here at the top 25, but there is an awful lot of crap being made. And
so
I'm going to
do another supplement saying the worst 25. Films
well, I've kind of negated the need for it, but I think it might spark a debate. The worst 25 films is a lot easier. Well, no, it's just harder because there's a lot more to choose from.
250.
But we never say it. We always, you know, we go to Edinburgh, we say, oh, marvellous, all this British film activity. To be honest, you know, I go up there thinking, God, please don't let them all be shit.
So let's look on the bright side then. What are in your personal top 10?
My personal top 10, it's very good. I'm glad you asked me, because I don't have the list with me. But Trainspotting wasn't in my list. Widnall and I was certainly in my list. Sexy Beast was certainly in my list. Man on Wire was in my list. Hope and Glory, John Borman's 1987 war memoir, is definitely on my list. I was looking for a controversial one. I was thinking, well, can I pick one? This Is England was certainly on my list.
I think that would be on mine.
And Ratcatcher was on my
list. Ratcatcher would certainly be on mine. Ratcatcher is one of the great British films, I think. I think I'd also put in something like Naked, Mike Lee's Naked, which I like.
It was difficult to choose a Mike Lee. You could have had sort of 5 Mike Lees or 10 Mike Lees, maybe. Really. So it is a fascinating list to sit there. And there's other people on there have been asked to contribute their list. People like Peter Morgan, the scriptwriter, Natalie Press, the actor, Joanna Hogg, the director. Who else is there? Edgar Wright, he's in there. Obviously, he's contributed a film that actually makes the list as well, Shaun of the Dead.
Shaun of the Dead is a great crowd-pleasing film. I think that might even sneak onto my list.
Do you think Another Four one? Weddings and a Funeral?
No. I mean,
might get into this one, sir.
The only good thing that can be said about Four Weddings and a Funeral is it's not Notting Hill, which I think is actively evil. Four Weddings and a Funeral is just stupid.
Well, you can see the list in the Observer Film Quarterly this weekend, published on Sunday, along with my essay about why British films are crap, apart from these 25 here that are really good. There's other things in there, including my reminiscence with John Landis about making American Werewolf in London, because Americans were making films in the 80s.
Wouldn't that be so depressing if that turned out to be the greatest British film of the 1980s?
Lips are sealed until the next full moon, Zan. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to see you as ever. You can read Zan Brooks' musings and interviews on guardian.co.uk/film.
Bishem Huang Lu, e dunque diamo il premio a Shia Chinese di Xiaolu Guo.
Thank you. So it's wonderful because it's a world premiere here, and it's the first screening actually was yesterday, and for every one of us it's first time in Locarno, so we won this first prize. Cannot be better.
That's director Xiaolu Guo accepting the prestigious Golden Leopard Award at the Locarno Film Festival in Switzerland just a few days ago for her feature, She a Chinese. And to tell me how that felt and some more about the film and her work as director and writer, I'm joined by Xiaolu in our Film Weekly studio now. So congratulations on that, Xiaolu, and welcome to Film Weekly.
Thanks.
It's so wonderful to see a British film, which we're claiming this one as, winning a prestigious international festival like this. Did you feel you were representing Britain? Do you feel you're representing China? Because your film is sort of a global film, isn't it?
I certainly don't feel presenting any country, and I think that's the point. The film is really it's about youth without certain clear cultural identity or national identity, and it's a film about a young white girl leave her village, come to big city, then come to the West to discover her youth, or in the globalised landscape.
Xiaolu, can you just very briefly tell us the story, the narrative of your film, Shia Chinese? What's it about?
Shia Chinese is kind of a portrait of a journey. A village young person tried to get out from her tedious or traditional background, come to city to find her meaning of youth, and eventually arrive to the West. So it's really the journey from the East to West.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the South China, in a small village in Zhejiang province.
And then you came to London to do you came to the National Film and Television School here. That's right. So your aesthetics, if you say, because that's what the film is quite interesting in the terms of the narrative that you said. It's got a new style of telling. Your aesthetics were founded where? A mixture of both? Kind of British social realism cinema and classical Chinese?
Certainly not British socialism cinema. I mean, if you talk about social realism, I think Chinese social realism is quite strong. I mean, influence on my film. But when I was in Beijing Film Academy, I stayed in the Beijing Film School for about 8 years, and then I became a film teacher there. I think in that school, the style is more really linked to the French cinema in the 60s and very much linked to Soviet filmmaking at that time.
Yeah, she and her Chinese is a reference to a Godard film, is it not?
It was kind of like funny joke. When I wrote a script, the working title is La Chinoise, and which is, of course, you know, the link to Godard. And for the 5 years during the script development, we called La Chinoise because the original idea is when I was 18, I watched Jean-Luc Godard's La Chinoise in a film school in Beijing. And we all laughed, all the Beijing kids all laughed, because it's a film about Parisian girl longing for Chinese Revolution. And but in a very funny way, because for Chinese, if you're from communist background, it's kind of romantic portrait of China Revolution. And yet now China is such a different place.
Yeah.
So I thought my film is really about this kind of reverse journey of a village girl, come from socialist background, all the way through, come to the West, to discover that so-called freedom land. Therefore, we call it La Chinoise as kind of funny quote.
And music is obviously very important within the film, and you've got a great composer that you work with, John Parrish, of course, has now worked with PJ Harvey and stuff. How did you come to work with him on this?
It was kind of, as I said, I was listening to some of PJ Harvey's song, especially this song, The Desperate Kingdom of Love, and I thought that the ending really resonated that sound, the melody and the lyrics of that song. So I was contacting PJ Harvey and John Parrish. But then after I met John Parrish, we think we're going to make something really interesting for the film. Because I didn't want to use any classical Chinese music, and I don't want to have any traditional shadow through the whole film style. And I wanted to use punk band from China, which in the film there's a 3 or 4 Chinese punk band, quite naive but very strong energy in the film. And then I used John Parrish's score, because it's quite a delicate film, quite sensitive film. And the score has to be paved really in different chapters when the character move on into different city, different places. And the music has to somehow support her inner landscape. So that's quite a work. And we work very together, and he's wonderful.
Congratulations on Shia Chinese. It's going to be at the London Film Festival in October, and then I think it's got distribution here in the UK for next year for February, so through Film 4. So we will be seeing it much larger, but we wanted to get here right early and congratulate you on your Golden Leopard at Locarno. Off to Edinburgh you go. Xiaolu Guo, thanks very much for coming on Film Weekly.
Thanks.
And that's it for another Film Weekly. The music featured on the show this week is from the soundtrack to Pedro Almodovar's Broken Embraces, composed by the brilliant Rodrigo Prieto. And the music you can hear in the background here is by Can, the excellent track Vitamin C. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for that intriguing Observer Film Quarterly magazine with those top 25 British films and my incendiary piece about the state of the British film industry and the main paper for my Trailer Trash column, of course. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer here at Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.